This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by Ken Katkin, a professor at law at Chase Law School. Welcome to the show, 2020 edition, Ken.
Oh, it's good to be here. Good to be back.
Well, before we get started on anything else, I've got a quick update before we get into the show, and that is you'll notice that this week, there is no traditional theme music. The traditional theme music that we use is a clip from a song called Love the Government by Il Papa Giraffe. We obtained the song on the Free Music Archive and have been using it within what we believe to be the parameters of the Creative Commons license. Recently, someone contacted us with a question about this, and until we are able to definitively resolve the issue, we won't be using it in our introduction. We're big supporters of the Free Music Archive and the great music that artists like Il Papa Giraffe make available there, and we appreciate that. In today's show notes, you'll even find a link to Love the Government so that you can check out the entire song and the rest of Papa Giraffe's offerings on the site, and all the other great stuff you can find there. So, with that out of the way, I think what we need to turn to first, Ken, is the Senate trial. So this week, we've been kind of waiting for this. The Democratic-controlled House sends over the articles of impeachment after a rather long delay. Now, despite the potential hope from some that Pelosi would use that delay as a method to get some concessions on processes for the trial, that doesn't appear to have worked, if it was even the intention. So the whirl of the trial is still really focused on the process itself right now. New witnesses, no new witnesses. If the Clinton procedures are used, the witnesses can be called, but it's going to happen on a case-by-case basis, meaning that, well, you might have some potentially uncomfortable votes on either side of the aisle. Trump himself, you know, Ken and I had talked about this about a month ago. He's really shifted his tune in a way that we thought he wants everything to be quick. He needs a speedy trial. And what he means by that, of course, is one without any new witnesses. So what do you think about this issue, Ken? The procedures? Are we going to get witnesses? Are we going to have a back and forth? What do you think happens here?
Boy, I don't know if we're going to get witnesses or not, because it's really going to come down to a very small number of votes. I think all of the Democrats, of course, which is 47 votes, will vote to have witnesses. There's going to need to be 4 Republicans who vote to have witnesses. And it seems very likely that Senator Murkowski will do that. It seems possible that Senator Collins or Senator Romney or Senator Alexander will do that. But I don't think any of those are sure things. So it's very hard to make a prediction here. What do you think?
Well, it is. I have been looking at this, and one of the people that I look at, Rand Paul, made kind of what seemed to me a weird position. Although I've looked at it more, maybe it's become a little bit less weird. And he's arguing that, look, witnesses are great, but if you're going to have witnesses, you've got to open it up to anybody's witnesses. Or in his words, quote, the president gets to call anybody he thinks would be good for his defense. The prosecution can call who they want, but I don't think we should selectively call witnesses that don't like the president, end quote. So this that would make for some pretty tough votes, especially if you're doing it on a witness-by-witness basis or on some kind of exchange program, both difficult for some Democrats and difficult for some Republicans. But voting to not have any witnesses at all also might be hard. So I'm with you. This is a bit of a difficult prediction to make. Ted Cruz this week offered that, hey, look, we should exchange witnesses effectively. If we are going to vote for one of yours, you're going to have to vote for one of ours. That's probably the most likely scenario. But I'm not sure if that's going to be the most useful or satisfactory scenario. I don't know. What do you think, Ken?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mitch McConnell will not like that, and he would rather have no witnesses. And really, from a, you know, I mean, this is a political proceeding, of course. It's not a legal proceeding, but if to the extent that it's mirroring a trial, the idea that, well, because one side gets to call a relevant witness, the other side gets to call an irrelevant witness, it doesn't really seem normal. It seems like a very strange thing that, you know, that although President Trump might want to try to call Hunter Biden or people like that.
Right.
Really, they have nothing to offer that would be relevant to any of the things that Trump is being accused of. So I think the Democrats might end up having to take a deal like that if it's offered, because I think they'd rather get relevant and irrelevant witnesses in than get no witnesses in. But I don't know. I don't really know if that's where it's all headed. And the other wild card here is Trump himself, because you know, whereas I think McConnell rather wisely from the Republican perspective would like to make this thing as short and sweet and boring as possible before reaching, you know, what everybody knows is going to be an inevitable acquittal. It seems that now that Trump has you know, got some fairly flamboyant lawyers. He just added Dershowitz and Ken Starr to his legal team.
Yes, just
that seems very That seems very inconsistent with what's in his own best interests, I think. And I think McConnell has Trump's own best interests in mind much more than Trump does, and that Trump is almost just all he wants is to make a circus out of this thing on TV, and that could make it actually very unpredictable for him, I think.
My sense is, ever since we talked about this, has been that Trump, what he kind of sees this is as a chance for vindication. So if we get all these things in, what seems like wrong maneuvering, what seems like a violation, a derelict of presidential duty, will become an obviously, you know, presidential act. Let's even set the truth of that aside. But I don't think that would come out one way or the other, regardless of what could be true.
Yeah, it's not going to help him. The more stuff that is aired, the worse that is for Trump, I think. I think that, you know, so you know, I guess the Democrats, if the Rand Paul or Ted Cruz type deal that you described of witness for witness, one for one, let's call them that way. If that's what's offered, I'm sure that the Democrats will vote for that rather than voting for no witnesses. You know, I think right now, I just think the numbers are so tight that it's really hard to predict which way it's going to go.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm going to have to place money on one or the other, I think that there's enough Republicans who don't want to go down against witnesses, because there's a few key here who have not yet made a statement, when really you could make a really quick statement, make this over, that I think that you will get the same one witness at a time votes that we saw in the Clinton proceedings. Now, I dare not hazard a guess as to what goes down with that, but I do think that's more likely than the alternative by a little bit.
Yeah, the other thing I think is interesting is at least a few of the potential witnesses are actually kind of wild cards themselves, and I would especially be thinking of John Bolton here. I think everybody seems to assume that it's going to be devastating to the president if Bolton testifies, but I'm not sure I would make that assumption. I really don't have any idea about what Bolton would have to say, but I think he's a real wild card.
Now, this also leads us into another big story this week, because really, there are so many stories that are coming out of the Senate trial, and I'm just going to kind of open it as the way that Politico did this week. They noted, quote, an explosive interview by an associate of Rudy Giuliani and government watchdogs report that Trump's freeze of the Ukraine military aid violated the law immediately shook up the political and strategic calculus for lawmakers just hours before the start of the impeachment trial. Or, in short, the question of could Lev Parnas be called as a witness. And this is a big deal, because he suggests that he's turned over a trove of information concerning potentially Pence's direct knowledge and Trump's direct knowledge of what's going on in Ukraine. But he too is, everybody in the Trump orbit is a bit of a wild card, as you were putting it a minute ago. I mean, I don't really know what to think about this, Ken, other than it just, well, there's my grounding for it. What do you think about his allegations against Trump?
So I think Lev Parnas is a different kind of wild card than John Bolton, because I think with John Bolton, I really don't know what he would say. With Lev Parnas, based on the documents that he himself went to court because he wanted to get the order allowing him to give them to the House investigators, and he himself has been going on Rachel Maddow the last couple nights, I think it's very clear which way he would testify. His testimony would be extremely damaging to President Trump. I think with him, the wild card aspect is not what he's going to say, but it's just how credible he's going to be.
And,
And so that, it's a little bit unknown. I think he has made, people have noted he has made a few misstatements in his Rachel Maddow interviews, particularly about timeline. I don't know that everything he says can be accepted as true, and people are going to be looking into this stuff a lot. So I think that's where the kind of unknowns are with respect to Parnas's testimony.
Now, the other thing that I think Parnas kind of exemplified for me is the number of people in the Trump orbit who are, I'm just going to go ahead and say what I've been thinking about, unstable. And what do you think this means for the trial? Because you were kind of hinting at it there, Ken. Effectively is that the cast of characters around Trump are an unstable bunch, in my opinion. And even when it seems like they're attempting to now kind of turn a new cloth, in a sense, they're really looking out for themselves again. How much of this can anyone take as credible or as evidence in a way that moves anything, even if it seems like there is some truth in there? If you had a different cast of people around Trump, it almost feels like the trial would be easier.
Well, Parnas himself, seems not to be the most credible person in the world. But Parnas also turned over a huge trove of documentary evidence, and so the documents will speak for themselves. And certainly, he was in Ukraine working for Rudy Giuliani, trying to come up with or fabricate or plant evidence that would discredit the Mueller report's account of Russian interference and turn it all into Ukrainian interference. So he was involved in that stuff. So, you could I think it'll certainly be easy to paint a picture of him as a less than honest person, and that might deflate the value of his testimony a little bit. But I think with all the documents that he turned over, that's really going to be the core of what's either going to establish or not establish the credibility of what he has to say.
Now, so and you started this off, and we've started this off and talked about it. There's almost a foregone conclusion that Republicans are going to vote no, and as a result, there's a quick outcome. And let's assume that's going to be the case. So, Ken, as you think about this, what about the calculus as it comes forward for the presidential election, which is, I think, the more likely scenario that this affects? If this goes away quickly, is that a benefit to Trump? Or would, and this is something that I've been kind of thinking about and wondering, does keeping a number of Democratic senators in Washington focused on this benefit Trump?
Well, I think that a more full-blown impeachment trial will be harmful to Republicans generally. And in that sense, I'm including Trump and also the Republican senators who are going to be running for election in swing states. The political impact, I think, is going to be bigger on certain senatorial elections than on the presidential election, because for people like Susan Collins or Cory Gardner in Colorado or McSally in Arizona, who all have to run now, I think if it looks like they're involved in a cover-up, that is going to hurt them electorally. And so I think that's where more of the electoral impact is going to be. I don't know that there's going to be a lot of electoral impact in the presidential election, no matter how it goes, because I think most Americans have already pretty much decided which side they're on with respect to the removal of Trump. And they're not going to be highly influenced to change their mind by the outcome of the Senate vote.
I don't disagree with you on that. And, I think that's something that'd be interesting to spend a little bit more time exploring at some point, potentially in a show. The question of whether the impeachment as it is even makes sense as a device, to even be a political device, does it make any difference? But I think for now, we'll probably let that stay there.
Just a quick break to thank SaneBox, the sponsor of today's show. You know, I've been for years trying to get my email under control. It's been a largely losing effort, but then I gave SaneBox a shot and it really transformed my inbox. As your email comes in, SaneBox leaves only the important messages in there and directs all the other distracting stuff to your Sane Later folder. And that means you know what messages to pay attention to now and what stuff can wait until later. It also has other great features like the Sane Black Hole that lets you drag messages from annoying senders you never want to hear from again. I'm sure you have them. I do. And Sane Reminders, which lets you know if someone hasn't replied to your email by a certain date, which is super useful in my experience. Best of all is that you can use SaneBox with any email, client, or phone anywhere you check your email. Check out how SaneBox can almost magically really remove distractions from your inbox with a free 2-week trial. Visit SaneBox.com/politicsguys today to start your free trial and get a $25 credit. That's SaneBox.com/politicsguys.
That's a big deal. As a matter of fact, we had talked about this, and this is one of the rare times, Ken, when you have admittedly got something wrong, and that was the USMCA. Yeah. On Thursday, the Senate easily passed Trump's revamp of NAFTA on a largely bipartisan vote. It passed 89-10. And of the 10 who were against, one is Minority Leader Schumer, who shifted his vote later due to not addressing climate change. So did Senator Sanders. But he was a lot stronger on this than any of the other Democrats. He voted no, in his words, quote, because, quote, it didn't contain a single damn mention of climate change, end quote. And this is also worth mentioning because it marks a break with Elizabeth Warren, a topic I think we're going to talk a little bit about more in a moment when we talk about the Democratic debates. So the deal, it passes. It passes overwhelmingly, clearly in a different kind of a climate. This would be maybe a bigger win for Trump. It's definitely a win for both Democrats and Republicans. It's also a big win, as we had talked about before, for labor unions. So I think I'm going to phrase it this way. Why is Senator Sanders holding out on this one? What do you think? I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I do want to admit, like, I like when I make predictions, I want to be held accountable. And I really thought McConnell and more Republicans would be interested in stopping this bill from coming up for a vote
because of the labor protections. Yeah, no.
Yeah. Because it purely every change that it makes to NAFTA is in the direction of to the left. Every single change to NAFTA comes from the Democrats, and none of them come from the Republicans. And there's now, we've replaced NAFTA with a much more labor friendly. And in fact, you know, despite what Sanders had to say, it's also more environmentally friendly. There are more environmental protections in USMCA than there were in NAFTA. It's just that they don't happen to have to do with climate change, but they do have to do with other environmental protections. And even the intellectual property parts of it are moved in a more liberal direction, where the intellectual property protections for pharmaceutical companies were weakened or eliminated, which is, all again, yeah, not something that you'd expect Republicans usually to support. So I think, you know, in the end, I suppose what I didn't see was that the Republican senators, by and large, were more anxious to stay aligned with Trump than to really stay aligned with what had traditionally been their own policy agenda. And Trump really wanted this victory, and he had negotiated it with Schumer, and he announced the deal, and I guess he didn't want the Republican senators to kibosh that, and in the end almost none of them voted to kibosh it. More of the no votes came from Democrats than came from Republicans.
Yeah, almost exclusively.
Yeah, I guess Toomey from Pennsylvania was a Republican who was against it, but not a lot of them. Yeah, and yeah. So Sanders, you asked me about, yeah.
Yeah, so that's all good. I mean, that was all worthwhile, but I do want to circle back around. I mean, this exactly right here, this is one of the things that I take issue with on Sanders. I mean, he can't ever take a win. Why have this big, nasty rhetoric on a thing where this is clearly a Democratic win? What is he waiting for? I don't understand it, and it makes me wonder who supports this guy. I don't get it. Help me, Ken. Explain.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll first say I'm on your side on this issue. I would have voted for the bill. So Yeah, so I'm not with Sanders here, but I think
But you're going to be at least more sympathetic than I am.
yeah. I think Sanders's position is that essentially all free trade deals with countries that are poorer than the United States bring wages down in the United States. So I think he's fundamentally against free trade with countries like Mexico, where jobs that can be moved to Mexico will pay lower wages and have lower worker protections than those jobs would have in America. And I think Sanders, rather than being willing to incrementally move things in what he would consider a right direction, he's kind of holding out for the idea that we should be ending these trade deals entirely. But I'll tell you, the fact that Sherrod Brown was strongly in support of this deal, I think really left Sanders isolated on this one, because Sherrod Brown is kind of who I think of as the main voice for labor in the Senate. And he thought this was very good for labor, and especially because it strengthens the ability of Mexican workers to unionize, which has got to be good for American workers.
And it raises their wages $16 to $16.50.
Yeah. And so that can only be good for American workers and especially for American unionized workers. And I think it's a big misjudgment on Sanders's part. And maybe there's a political aspect to it as well. Maybe he just wanted to differentiate himself from all the other Democratic candidates in the presidential race so that he could say that he's more pure than they are. But those are my interpretations anyhow.
Well, that first interpretation, if that's what he would have led with, to say, look, I'm just against free trade, which I think you're right. He is. But instead of framing it in that context, he has to frame it in the context of, well, this is not, there's nothing about climate change. And yeah, I get that the words climate change aren't in the agreement. But as you rightfully point out, it is being impacted. So I guess this is one of the problems that I fundamentally have with the Bernie part of the left, is they seem to be as intractable as many of the Trumpites on the right, and it just leaves me with a bad taste that he just cannot seem. Again, I wouldn't necessarily have come up with the USMCA, but I am for trade deals, and so this is what we're going to get because this is the climate that we're in. I don't know. It's bizarre to me the amount of support that Sander has. He's this. Well, this kind of takes us into our other topic. But I mean, this is an example for me at least where I simply cannot understand what is appealing, even when I try to put myself into the shoes of somebody else, of Sanders.
I guess there is a political constituency for someone who wants to take the strongest possible position against trade deals, and I guess that's really just where he's positioning himself.
Well, since we're already kind of going down that trail anyway, why don't we talk a little bit about the Democratic debate this week? One of the big interesting points is, of course, this is the last debate before we're going to have our first actual vote. So we're going to have at least a little bit more information next time we come around. We're talking about the subject. But the thing that got a lot of attention and maybe shouldn't have gotten a lot of attention, but it continues to have steam, has been the play in the Bernie versus Warren. That, I mean, in all honesty, that seems to be the media's horse race in this one, which is probably, it hasn't maybe been the, and this is where, think about it. So before we get too deep in that, let me just ask you this, Ken. Has the fact that the media has been focusing the horse race on Bernie and Warren been a benefit or a hindrance to Biden? What do you think about that? I have a thought here, but I'm curious what you have to say first.
Yeah, that's probably a benefit to Biden, and I think that may be the point of it. I think the media, the sort of most mainstream media, for various reasons, both policy reasons and electability reasons, is not trying to help either Warren or Sanders, and so kind of pitting them against each other like this is a way that some components of the media will try to maybe influence the primaries towards a more a centrist candidate.
So that is actually the same. It's funny how we often agree on these things, but
yeah.
we're probably the most ideologically opposed on the show, and yet I feel sometimes that we have the least visceral disagreement.
we diagnose problems the same way, or we analyze what's going on the same way. I think so.
I mean, it seems to me that Biden not having a focus for his misspeaking moments is an advantage to him. But it seems odd to me, though, that the other candidates now, and this maybe they seem to be playing into this. I mean, Bernie and Sanders and Warren, they both could have easily made this week's big story just kind of go away. But they didn't. So I do want to bring it up, although it's kind of a minor one. So there's a report this week that Sanders, in a meeting with Warren, told her that a woman can't win the presidency. Now, he has denied that. And Warren has actually now, both in and outside of the debate, said, no, that's exactly what Sanders said. And there at the debate, of course, was the tense moment. And then after the debate, apparently, it appears, if you take a look at the video clip, maybe even a little bit more than a tense moment. So why do you think, if this is a benefit to Biden, why is Sanders and Warren willing to go down this and duke it out on this path? It seems like a lose-lose for both of them, but maybe there's something I'm missing here. What do you think, Ken?
Yeah, well, I agree it's a lose-lose for both of them. And I think they both, their instinct was to not air this kind of dirty laundry on national television. But I think there was a little bit of manipulation of both of them by the way CNN introduced that issue into the debate. Because I think when Bernie was asked the question, and he flatly denied it and said that it was a lie, at that point, Elizabeth Warren herself had never yet publicly said it. So I think that Bernie had been, under the impression that this was something that was perhaps being leaked from the Warren campaign, but that it wasn't something that had come out of Warren's own mouth, and that if he just denied it, then, she would say something more unequivocal, like, we may remember it differently or something. But then, meanwhile, I think she construed his statement as that he was actually calling her a liar. And then I think she couldn't let that go. And also she was very much egged in that direction by the form of the question, because after Bernie denied it, the follow-up question to her was basically, of the form, well, what do you have to say about the fact that Bernie is lying?
Audience's enjoyment at that moment, interestingly. Continue.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was no basis for that question, because even if you want to look at things most favorably to Warren's version of the story, this was a private conversation between the two of them. So there's really no way that a reporter could know which one of them was lying. But the CNN reporter kind of egged her on by kind of saying, like, we all know that he's lying. What do you have to say about that? And
right.
So I think they. Yeah, so I think they got really manipulated into having a very public conflict, when it seems like this is something that they may genuinely remember differently than one another. And in that interchange afterwards that you talked about, I think the CNN ended up, they did have that interaction after the post debate interaction on a live mic, so they have released that audio, and she's saying, you called me a liar on national television, and he's saying, look, we're still on television. Let's talk about this later. And she's like, well, okay, anytime. And I think that Bernie's instinct continuously there was like, let's not talk about this in public. It's not good for anybody. But I think Warren momentarily kind of lost her temper about that, but just very momentarily. And now I think they've both been trying hard to make the story go away. And I hope it doesn't have the effect of turning any Democratic voters into really thinking very badly of one or the other of those two candidates, because there's really nothing more important here than that. From my perspective, than the Democratic Party stay unified. And these kind of media-generated tiffs are not going to be good for anybody on the Democratic side of the aisle at all.
Well, now here is, so I mean, I don't disagree with you. I think that on part you're right here is that there's no win on the Democratic side for this schism. But this kind of then brings me back. Sanders, in many ways, is a strange, and I don't mean on his viewpoints. We were kind of talking about that a minute ago. But he's a strange demographic beast, if you think about it. I mean, so he's arguing, look, I'm pro-female, I am pro-racial diversity, I am pro-younger people, but I'm going to run against all of you as an old white man. And, I mean, is Sanders being in this race a fundamental contradiction to his own beliefs? And that's something I've been wrestling with. In other words, by his own metric, shouldn't he be just stepping aside?
Maybe, but you know, in fact, the you know, one of the ironies of the dust up with Elizabeth Warren that we were just talking about is that by all accounts, he had that same viewpoint that you just expressed in 2016, and he apparently did go to Elizabeth Warren in 2015 and say, "I think you should run for president, and if you run for president, I won't, and only if you don't run for president will I get into it because we need a left candidate in there," and apparently, he was, in fact, willing to defer to her in 2016, and she decided not to run. And that's when he ran, and he became the only candidate to run against Hillary, really, in 2016. So now I think in 2020, you know, I think partly because he did better than expected in 2016 and built up a name and a following and all that, I think he felt like he'd already put a lot of the groundwork in, and he is still one of the main front runners right now. I think he is still ahead of Warren, in fact. And I suppose the other reason that he stays in is I think he believes that what's really needed now is not only someone as far to the left as possible, but also someone who's fundamentally whose attitude towards Republicans is fundamentally that he's not trying to work with them. He's trying to defeat them. And I think he thinks, you know, there's a little bit too much rhetoric about being able to work across the aisle and things like that among the other candidates. And he just thinks there needs to be an alternative that's not talking that way. And, you know, maybe Warren is kind of like him in that regard. But you know, I think if he and Warren could settle their differences and actually choose, you know, only one of them to stay in and one of them to get out, whichever one it was, then the one that stayed in would have a very good chance of becoming the nominee. As long as they're both in, they're almost certainly going to split the vote on each other, and neither of them's going to be the nominee. So I mean, there's a lot of ironies to all this, but I think on your first question about based on ideas about the youth vote and the women's vote and things like that, is a very old white man the right messenger. You know, I think ultimately his real agenda is like a FDR type economic liberalism, and although he is progressive on race and gender and those kind of issues, really I think his bottom line is that he's progressive on economic issues, and so in that sense it may not be that inapposite for him to be the age that he is.
In short, it's economics trumps these other identities, and that is in fact I think part of maybe a bit of a split on the left that is has yet, maybe this is an example, an early bubbling of this kind of coming to the fore. Because one of the things, you know, I have a number of people that I follow, I'm close with across the aisle. I was a little bit surprised. And so this is kind of my last question on this one for you, Ken. And again, it's not a representative sample. So, you don't want to carry these kinds of conclusions too far. But I was surprised by the amount of anger and vehemence that this brought out between people that I knew on the inside who were Sanders supporters versus those who were Warren supporters. And I wonder, does that ultimately benefit Donald Trump? I think probably, but what do you, I mean, why do you think this why is the left so particularly, again, this is my impression, so help me on it.
Yeah.
Do you think that, is my sample representative? Do you think that people are as upset as it appears about this? And why is this the thing that's upset, especially if the goal is to beat Trump?
I do think people are people who are supporting Sanders or Warren are forming very negative opinions about the other candidate right now. I think it's serious, and I think it's terrible. And I think the two of them need to really get on message together and put a stop to this quickly. It's not gonna benefit them. The only theory I even saw of how this could benefit either one of them, and I'm not sure I buy it, but I'll run this one by you. It's not my theory. So I heard somebody saying that. Warren will benefit from this because neither one of them are going to be the nominee. You know, one of the centrists is going to be the nominee, but that one of the raps on Warren is that people don't think she's enough of a fighter. And so here she's showing that she's a fighter, and that will set her up more to be someone's vice presidential nominee, to be someone's running mate, and that's the benefit to her. Now, I don't know that I buy that, but I think that's a possible explanatory theory of how she could benefit from it. But I actually think both Sanders and Warren still think that they could be the nominee. I don't think they're already looking for how they can demonstrate their suitability to be anybody's running mate. And that theory would really be focused on that. I think they need to patch up their differences quickly, and that the Democratic Party needs to stay unified. Really, the only path to victory for Trump is through Democratic disunity, I think.
Which is bad news for Democrats, because just objectively, unity on your side has not always been your strongest suit as a party, at least in recent elections. I don't disagree, and it's and I think you're right. I mean, I think that theory floats too much. There hasn't even been a vote yet, so it seems really unlikely that anybody's going to just take a look at some poll numbers, especially if you're polling pretty well in the top tier, and say, I'm going to start shooting for VP. In January. That seems unlikely to me as a guy who studied political science. But, you can't ever rule anything out entirely. But I'd put it low down on the possibility. It is also interesting. This is what you had suggested a number of months ago. I tried to goad you into picking your favorite candidate.
Yeah.
and your answer effectively was, and I remember, was, look, I don't care who it is. We just got to pick somebody. And
yeah,
you're right.
That's what I still say.
Yeah. And it was easier to say then. And I think that it's getting increasingly hard. I don't mean to say it, get any traction behind it now. And this is probably an example of that. And you're right. If they don't get together on this, I see your hope on that front, at least, being dashed.
I'll still say personally, as an extremely anti-Trump Democrat, which I am, I would take any of these candidates, and I don't want to get in a mental space right now where I think like, I hate this candidate or I hate that candidate. All the Democratic candidates I would rather have than Trump. And I think it's important for Democrats to really think that way and to not start picking apart our own candidates.
Well, and the one that I would have liked the most on the left, Cory Booker, of course, is out. So, yep. Things sometimes
aren't. You got Bloomberg now. How what do you think about Bloomberg?
Bloomberg is a fascinating character. And I think really this is just a way for him to try to shoot money against Trump. And if that is in fact the case, then that's not a bad move on his part. But Bloomberg, the candidate, just. I don't know. I would much rather if we're going to defeat Trump with somebody, I would much rather us move towards a president who is not going down the popularity billionaire class point of view. And this is coming from a libertarian. and on that front, I would say, and I don't mean that in kind of a Marxist economic way, but I'm worried that if we continue to make the presidency, if we make celebrity a prerequisite for the presidency, that we will have fundamentally harmed the office. And I'm afraid that in a different way, Bloomberg would reinforce the idea that pre-existing celebrity is in fact a necessary or a positive quality prior to running. I've never phrased it quite that way. What do you think about that, Ken, before we move on?
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. I don't like these billionaires in there. And, you know, even though I don't have a, I mean, I Steyer, you know, if he weren't a billionaire, I might even like him better. I like the a lot of his positions, but I don't think that's the right place for candidates to come from.
Well, I really worry that we're going to end up in a world where rather than having to have a religious test is something we're worrying about, we're going to have to worry about the, well, how much of a celebrity test are you, right? It's going to be, if you haven't already had a TV show, well, then you're not going to be able to run for office effectively. And that's really what kind of concerns me when I put it in that way. Well, I think we still have time for one story, which is perfect because we got one left. So, Ken, this week we had electronic privacy issues part two. Apple has been in the face of the nation again, as Barr has suggested that Apple needs to do a heck of a lot more when it comes to unlocking a cell phone. Attorney General Barr has asked Apple that they need to get more involved with a iPhone 5 and an iPhone 7 concerning a shooting at a naval station in Pensacola, Florida. Now, we actually talked about this, Ken, a long time ago, different shooting, different issue, but the FBI ended up unlocking that phone in a different way, and that kind of just dissolved the case and dissolved everything. But this time, Trump himself is actually getting involved, tweeting that it's time for Apple to step it up. They're getting all these things. It's time for them to start unlocking cell phones. And in fact, what he's pushing for is a back door, although I'm not sure that Trump knows what that means in electronic terms. And this is kind of specifically interesting because we have learned that in Ohio, it appears that the newest model iPhone was unlocked using some fancy new hardware. So this kind of makes a new question about, is the FBI making this push in the Pensacola case specifically to create incident to push Apple on this? Why this renewed push for electronic backdoors? So Ken, as a lawyer, give us some idea here. We talked about this before, but I think it's worth talking about again. I don't remember, where do you come down on having backdoors on devices?
Yeah, I don't think it's a good thing. There is a federal statute that requires it. So, you know, as from a legal perspective, there's a statute called the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which was enacted in 1994, I guess after the first World Trade Center bombing. And it does require that phone companies design phones in ways that it's possible for law enforcement pursuant to a warrant to be able to penetrate security. So I don't think Barr's position is crazy on the law when he's trying to make use of the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. But I think it's a bad idea because all of these American phone manufacturers are in competition with foreign phone manufacturers, and they're selling into global markets. And if other countries, are going to not have people in other countries, especially, might not like the idea that U.S. Law enforcement and intelligence agencies are going to spy on everybody who's in other countries, and they're not going to have phones like that. You know, I think we're just putting our own phone companies at big disadvantage in global markets. And I think there's the actual need for this kind of thing is so rare, and the ability, in fact, of law enforcement to be able to penetrate security of these phones, if they just try hard enough, seem almost always to work. That I just can't see the need for it. I see a lot more downside to it.
Now, on the statute you were talking about, that is one I'm familiar with. But now you're the lawyer, so correct me. But I did not believe that had ever yet been extended to the rest of an electronic device. So in short, wasn't that specifically over the records of what's occurring on phone calls, not to necessarily what's being contained on a hard drive?
Yeah, you're actually right about that. So I may have overstated the case for what's covered by Khalil.
Okay, not trying to push you back to. I was just trying to make sure I understood.
Yeah,
because you know what you have in your pocket now is basically a tiny computer. And nobody that was not something that the thought there as you look at the statute is it's the communications that occur between that device and the carrier, not the stored content.
Yeah. Right. So that's right. So Khalil means that law enforcement must have the ability to eavesdrop on real time communications, but it does not extend to the ability to look at stored communications.
Now, and this then brings us to because. Encryption still remains legal, does it not?
Yeah.
So if I'm right, that's what then kind of confused me about the bar push is, so if a company like Apple, which has now this week responded, look, we've turned over gigabytes of data that was not encrypted to you, pursuant to your to warrants, what is the justification then that I mean, so if a company sells me a safe, they wouldn't necessarily, that safe company wouldn't be able to get served a warrant and say, well, you got to be able to hack into the safe in my house just because there could be evidence in it. So I was very confused about what the push from the attorney general here is, because like you, I worry about the idea. I mean, I'll use myself as an example, right? My all day heart rate is on my device because I wear a wearable, I wear a Garmin device. My GPS location as a result of my runs and my heat maps are on there. And those aren't things that I share with the rest of the world. They're in fact things that I have encrypted, not because I'm trying to, keep my whereabouts a secret for nefarious purposes, but I don't want the rest of the world to know what my favorite running location is at the time of day that I do it. It just strikes me as a particularly forward push by the attorney general on this one, I guess because you're a lawyer. Well, I'm not throwing that to you.
Yeah. So I agree with you and I don't like it, but I think also from that side, the argument shouldn't be overstated because this would only be your privacy and the kind of stuff that you're just talking about would only be threatened under the bar position if there was probable cause and a judge had actually issued a warrant to allow a law enforcement agency to get that information that you otherwise would be holding private. Right. So he's not arguing that law enforcement should be able to routinely monitor all kinds of private information. What he's arguing is that in particular instances where the legal standard for getting a search warrant has been met and where the information that's the subject of that search warrant has been encrypted, that he would like for courts to order technology companies to be willing to use their technology to help execute that warrant. Yeah, unlock. So I still don't like it, but I think it doesn't, that position doesn't threaten all the legitimate reasons that people use encryption. It only threatens, really at the margin, some uses of encryption to protect information that there's probable cause to believe is evidence of a crime.
Now, on that, if there was some way to separate the two, I think I'd be more willing to have a middle ground. But what concerns me is that the only way to undo my encryption is effectively to have a way to break it, which is going to mean it, just because it's there doesn't mean Apple isn't the only place that's going to be able to potentially break it. A lot of people can break it. Here's why. I'll be honest why this has been on my mind. I was actually targeted as an OC employee. Now, as a result of, I have some pretty meticulous takes, I actually had a student who was trying to do, to get into some things, and it did not work, but it reminded me of, had I not taken those safeguards or had there been less sophisticated protection there, they would have had an access to a trove of my data. I guess that's what makes me worry about that is, so if you have the capability to undo my production, that means that you know, some cybersecurity kid from the university might be able to targetly attack you.
Yeah, that could be right, although that could go either way, right? Because it could be that if the encryption is so strong that nobody would be able to hack it, but it's just that Apple would be able to have the key so that they could unlock the key, that nobody would break the lock, but they would unlock the lock, then that might actually make you safer against outside hackers, right? Whereas if you have a situation where Apple's not going to help, and so law enforcement's going to have to put their own hackers to work figuring out how to break this encryption. Well, once they figure it out, maybe that information will get out, and other people will be able to use it. So, you know, so it's so I think that's an empirical question. Which of those is more true empirically?
Well, I mean, that's what maybe we'll have to look into some more. But I think at this juncture, Ken, I'm about to say it's been wonderful being on the show with you, and I look forward to our next meeting here in just a few weeks.
Great. Yes. Happy New Year to you, and it's good to be back.
Thanks, Ken. And thank you for listening to Ken and I on The Politics Guys. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate doing the show with you, and I wanted you to know that if you are a supporter, here in a moment, Ken and I are going to be doing a bonus show. And that means if you support us on Patreon, you'll have the opportunity for a bonus show, and this show and all other shows ad-free. That's right. So I would love for you to head to our Patreon page, patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can head to politicsguys.com/support. I also really love to hear it if you guys have comments, questions, or other issues. As a matter of fact, you can catch us now on our Reddit page. But for normal inquiries, you can hit us up at mail@politicsguys.com or our Facebook page, facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter at Politics Guys. Subscribing to the show really helps, and like I noted, there's a lot of really cool bonus material. So I hope you'll share it with a friend, and if nothing else, that you've enjoyed the episode. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Morano, Andra Masker, and Daniel Toe. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. I hope you'll join us then.